VentureCast.
Wow, well, I don't know because it's not Sweet Child of Mine.
Nope, that is the third single.
Oh my God, what did they think?
Just
was
pause
the
for
single?
A second. Just
oh, I know what
Americans
it is.
And anyone who's ever had ears, they listened to this record and they weren't like, let's release Sweet Child of Mine, which was a number one pop hit, like a gargantuan worldwide hit. And it's not the song I'm gonna make Jeff play, but it's a fantastic song.
No
it's
question.
One of the rare rock songs that you can play for my daughters and they're like, wow, that was great. Do the rest of the song sound like that? And I'm like, I got some bad news for you.
No.
I got good news. That song's great. The bad news is you're not going to care for the rest.
50 years of music with 50-year-old white guys.
Fellas.
Jimmy!
How's it going? What the listeners are missing is the three of us talking about the listening habits of ourselves on our own podcast. Jeff Simons, we have produced how many podcasts by this time?
Over 80, right?
Jeepers. And of those 80, how many have you listened to?
None. which means I'm even with my wife, yeah, who is also listening.
You're as big a fan of our podcast as your wife.
Well, I keep repeating all the same jokes. I'm like, hey, I have something clever. And then, you guys give me the look like, no, already told that story.
Meanwhile, Ben Barton, 8 a.m. on Wednesdays, what are you doing?
Oh, I'm driving to work and listening to myself on the podcast. And I just want to clarify, I killed me. That material is awesome. I'll just be frank. You guys are fine, but I'm amazing. Like, just hilarious, so insightful.
That's how I feel while we're doing it. I mean, that's my review every time we hang up. I'm like, boy, that Ben guy is like the big wheel on the tricycle for sure.
I picture Ben like rewinding after certain points that he makes. Like, wait a minute, I want to hear that again.
Oh, gotta hear it twice.
It's too bad it doesn't have the like noise when you rewind it.
No, I was saying, I actually listened to it at the gym. I was at the gym today and I'm like there at the gym like laughing at my own jokes and I'm like, this is a little squirrely. I'll just go ahead and admit it. It's not a great look.
This is what we do. We are 50 awesome. Years of music with 50-year-old white guys on the Drive-In Podcast Network. Go to the Drive-In Podcast Network, musiccitydrivein.com. for all the podcasts you want, all the interviews with celebrities, all the movie reviews, television reviews. We've got it all there. So, gentlemen, it is 1987.
Yeah.
This is actually
graduation year.
You graduated from high school, correct?
Indeed.
This is the year, man. This is a big year.
On a scale of 1 to 10, 10 being great, 1 being, how did you rate your senior year of high school?
I'd have to go 9. I had a really good senior year of high school.
Holy cow.
Really good friends. The band I was in gigged a lot, made a record, was on the radio. Really nice.
What was the name of that
super
band?
Sweet first girlfriend. SFX was the name of the first band.
That's correct.
And by the way, I just want to clarify. I have met many of Jeff's friends from high school and they just say that band was amazing. It was a huge hit. They loved it in Annapolis. That being said, having listened to our own podcast, it's my understanding that in the last 4 weeks, Jeff has spent like the flat earth. Our band played 4 songs from Thomas Dolby's The Flat Earth.
We weren't good enough.
Right? And then you were like, last week, you were like, oh yeah, we played like 6 songs from this dumb record. And I was like, who is going to see this band? Who's like, oh, it's the 6th song from the debut record by this boring band.
So somebody sent me a tape of a bootleg of us, like digitally, like said, like, I found this in my basement. I digitized, you have to hear this. And somebody had bootlegged one of our shows.
Okay.
We used to play 4 55-minute sets. That was a show. We'd play for 55 minutes, take a 5-minute break, 55 minutes, 5-minute break, 55 minutes, 5-minute break, and an hour.
That's
right.
Insane.
So it was a 4-hour show. We'd start at 7:30 and we'd play till midnight. Because we were like, well, you know, we got to fill the whole night. We never had a band with us on the bill.
We've trapped them in the house.
Our shows
also
were like,
I mean, your story is like, in 1880, there wasn't much to do.
No,
we
I
didn't
know.
Have a radio. Everyone gathered around to hear us for 4 hours.
It was crazy. Well, the thing is so funny is We played 50 songs in a show. So when you're playing six smithereens songs, there's still 44 other songs.
Oh my God.
But on this tape, at
I
the
would
end,
think by the sixth smithereens song, oh, people might have had it.
So here's the thing. At this show, there's like there's like a couple hundred people when it starts. At the end, after 4 hours of punishing full volume, like no ballads, just bang, 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 bang for 3 hours, you hear us finish a song, and there's like 25 people left, and I say with meaning it, yeah, thanks for staying. Like, I'm all pissed. I'm pissed at the 300 people that peeled off after 3 hours and 45 minutes. It was the funniest thing I've ever heard me say. That I was laughing. I just love it. I'm so grateful to.
And just to clarify, if you press that on vinyl, that's a triple live album. Am I right?
No, we did not. We made
it a quadruple live album. Like,
how
many vinyl records is that 4 hour show?
I think that's.
It would have had to have been eight, right? Or no, six. It would have been a six or seven album.
Oh man,
that'd have been great. Take that, Bruce Springsteen.
We got to share that with our listeners. I think they, if they have the time to listen to our podcast, they probably have the time.
Nobody has time for that.
These are
Nobody.
Busy professionals. Come on.
All right, Ben Barton, you senior year of high school?
Senior year of high school, up and down, but mostly up. I'm going to put it at 7.5.
Nice. Okay. Pretty solid.
Oh, Jeff mentioned, I'll just give a brisk version of one of the things that went wrong in my senior year of high school. My senior year of high school, it was just semesters. So my second semester, and it's divided into three sections where you get a fake report card, a fake report card, and the real report card.
Okay.
I get my schedule. The last class on my schedule is gym. And I'm like, second semester senior year, man, they're sending me a message. I go ahead and cut gym class like 10 times the first trimester. Just like, I was just like, I don't feel like going. I just went off and hung out with my friends or my girlfriend or whatever else. Anyway, I get the first grade thing. It comes in. Everything's fine. I'm on pace to graduate except for gym F.
Uh-oh.
Just failing gym. So gym class in Brooklyn, New York, in public schools, 125 kids.
Oh my
and
God.
And run by evil sadists, just like the cruelest, most evil people. As an example of evil sadism, they would make everybody do a chin up. So you have 120, it's only boys, 125 boys from 9th grade to 12th grade waiting in line to do a chin up.
Just one chin up.
No. If you could do one chin up, then they'd help you on the further chin ups. But if you couldn't do one chin up, they just let you hang. And you would just be hanging there, like sweating, trying to pull up. It's Mr. Abuse. He was the assistant coach of the football team. And then Mr. Chikarian. Those are the two gym teachers. So Mr. Arbuse, if you couldn't do a chin up, he would just sit there and laugh like, ha, 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 ha. And he was like a big fat Jabba the Hutt guy, just pointing at you laughing. That's the level of sadism that we're doing.
Da, da, Wookie chin up.
And of course, there's like another 100 kids behind you, all of whom are laughing at you. And you can't do a chin up. By the time I got to senior year, I could do a chin up. I was like, I've got it made. I'm going to be fine. But I mean, ninth grade was tough.
Miserable.
Really tough. Anyhow, so I fail. I go to see Mr. Arbuse. I'm like, Mr. Arbuse, what's going on? Like, I'm a senior. You know how this goes. And he goes, Barton, you cut. And when you cut, you fail. I was like, well, okay, that's fine. I understand that. He's like, no, you don't understand, Barton. There's nothing you can do now. You're in my hands and you're going to fail. So I was like, well, maybe there's something I could do. And he was like, you got to come to class every day early, Barton. You got to show me something. So I'm like, all right, fine. So I stop cutting. I make it all the way through the second trimester. Second fake grade comes out still just like a zero. Like I'm just a hard fail. At this point, they move me out of my senior homeroom into a junior homeroom. And they're like, you're not graduating. Like you're done. Like you're going to fail. You're in this failing grade where like, we're just going into prep.
Oh my God.
So I go to Mr. Arbus. I'm like, dude, I'm headed off to college. Like, surely you're going to help me out here. And he's like, oh no, Martin, I'm not going to help you out. Because Martin, I think I told you, when you cut, what happens?
You fail.
You fail. So I was like, dude, I haven't cut since then. He's like, but it's too late, Martin. It's too late. And he's like, and when you fail, you go to summer school. And I was like, you're not going to admit. He was like, oh, you go to summer school, Barton. And I went to Midwood High School. He was like, you don't go to summer school in Midwood, Barton. You go in Madison. And then Madison was famous because they had what a fancy person like me would call a portcullis, but was what Mr. Arbus called a gate. They had a gate that rolled down to hold people into the school at the time. And he was like, they're going to lock you in, Barton. They're going to put you behind the gate. I was like, so my parents are freaking out. They're like, dude, you might even not get to go to college. Like, they're going to notify college you didn't graduate. And I was like, you know, it's going to work out. It's going to work out. I promise you it's going to work out.
This is when you became my hero and I didn't even know you yet.
So we have the senior prom. And the senior prom is, because it's in New York, it's on like a Tuesday night or a Wednesday night. It's a weeknight because we get this really nice venue. We go, we have the senior prom. I rent the tux. I rent the limo. I've got a lovely girlfriend. We spend the whole night out dancing. We go out to watch the sunrise on the beach.
Okay.
At Manhattan Beach. Then I asked the limo to take me back in my tuxedo to high school, where I arrive in time for gym class. I've skipped the whole rest of the day. I roll into gym class in my tuxedo, don't change into my shorts, just sit down. There's 125 kids there and one kid in a tuxedo. And Mr. Arby's goes, Barton, is that you, Barton? Stand up. So I stand in my ticket and he goes, I like your style. You pass, Barton. And that was it.
That's the greatest.
That man is a tyrant.
Oh, man, he was so bad. He was a monster.
He was a monster.
He has all the power. Just indeed. mock young boys trying to be strong.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
God. That's actually not even the best gym school story that Ben has, but I won't make him tell anymore on the air. But I mean, you could make a whole comedy record of Ben goes to gym class at Midwood High School. It's unbelievable. Unbelievable.
All right.
Sorry, Timmy, I hijacked for a minute.
No, that's fun. that guy's voice is in my head now. 1987, what a year. Y'all know what album we were listening to. It is the Grammy winner.
It's the Grammy winner.
The Joshua Tree by U2.
Jeff Simons, what song? Jeff, where'd you go? You went to some place.
I'm muted because I was causing problems in the in the last episode with my live mic on it. That song is so great. You know, it's so funny. That record's damn near perfect. Like it peters out at the end with Exit and Mothers of the Disappeared, neither of which is a bad song, but I mean, good Lord, 1 through 9 is just as strong as music gets.
It's really
and good. I feel also, like
and I think that Timmy's going to agree with me on this for sure. Like, they're like quasi-spirituality really, really, really speaks to me. Like, there's some legit Christian songs by them where I'm like, well, this is a religion I can believe in. You know what I mean? And this is one of those. Like, it's just so beautiful. Their description of nature and the feeling of it. Like, it's almost like Spinoza. You know what I mean? Like, it's just gorgeous.
Well, it's super transcendental. I mean, I'm not a religious person, but I am a transcendentalist at heart. And like these guys nail that completely. I feel like U2 is the band where we're the exact right age. We hit them right at the right time. Like a lot of the music we love, we were on the other side of, right? Like they'd already peaked or they were already famous, but like we grew up right when U2 blew up. And I mean, you know, I was 18 years old when this, when I saw this show at JFK Stadium with 106,000 other people at the absolute apex of this band's career. And so they will always like these, this record just, I, you know, I can't hear any of these songs and not just immediately like, you know, I start speeding and I'm screaming along. And like, I just love this record. I just love it.
That's an actual great discussion topic for us to cover, not for today, but like peak band at the time in our lives.
Yeah.
This is a good one, but this wouldn't even be like top five for me. And I love that, but this wouldn't be. For
me. No, I mean, I think there was, I don't think even U2 was my favorite band when they should have been my favorite band. But I remember being in that stadium and like, you know, I am seeing this band at the absolute top of the iceberg.
Right. Top, and I was at that show standing, too, in the 40s when we walked.
Top of Mount Everest.
And so great. Well, let's move on. We are gonna talk about events in 1987. Whose brain is the quickest right here on a Wednesday night at 9:19 p.m. In 1987, the first woman is inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Who is it?
Tina Turner.
Got to be somebody earlier than that. Aretha Franklin.
Aretha Franklin is the correct answer. Is the
well done
inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Ben Barton, that's a long walk home for you after.
No, it's not. At least he didn't say like Joan Jett or somebody like that. You know, Tina Turner is a good guess.
Ronald Reagan nominates Robert Bork to the Supreme Court. Ben Barton, you'd be interested to know that for the Situation, the Scituate High School newspaper, I wrote an opinion piece defending Robert Bork and his appointment or his nomination to be a Supreme Court justice. Some of the other editors came after me and wrote their own opinion piece, but I felt I defended Robert Bork quite well.
Nice. What was your defense?
Yeah, I really didn't know very much. I just kind of heard that he, I think my last line was, Bork wants to defend the Constitution, not rewrite it. I think I did something
well
like
done,
that.
Well done, Timmy. You captured that. Good. That's a nice bumper sticker for Robert Bork, for sure.
But now I never thought Bork should be Supreme Court because he sounds way too much like the Swedish Chef's noise. Bork, bork, bork. That's all I could think of the whole time those confirmation hearings were happening. Like, I kept waiting for, like, the flim is okie dokie. Bork, bork, bork. Like, that's all I had in my head because that's the kind of deep intellectual I was.
Yeah, that's good stuff. Now, Ben, I don't know what kept him off the court. He was a little too
So it's really, right. It's actually sort of interesting. Like Nixon had a series of guys who got bounced, and then Bork got bounced. And basically, like, it's a lot higher salience now to get on the Supreme Court, and that's not necessarily good. Like the way that the confirmation process works now is really super poisonous. And, right. And Bork is one of the people that people point to. And honestly, the thing that's a little bit hard about it is he basically got bounced for his views. Some of which were the views of Ronald Reagan. I don't know. I have mixed opinions about it. He wasn't like, he didn't get bounced because he was dumb. He didn't get bounced because he smoked pot. He didn't get bounced because he sexually harassed somebody. He got bounced because of his views.
Yeah. Which were
some, I mean, he was definitely anti-abortion and he was a pretty strict constructionist. But the funny thing is that like, this is one of the things, like you fight against somebody for their views and then pretty soon there's four other guys in the court or six other guys in the court who have all the same views.
I mean, right. Yeah, that's where we are. All right. We haven't had the invitation to cynicism question in a long time, really since season one. But here it is, your invitation to cynicism.
The Situation suck in 1987?
It did not. How dare you, sir?
Wait, you're not letting me and Jeff talk.
My question is about a song that comes out in 1987. Rick Astley's Never Gonna Give You Up.
The Rick Roll.
Were we right in 1987 to hate that song? Or given what's been happening in the last, 30 years regarding that song. Should we have given it more of a chance and kind of embraced the fun side of music?
Let me just say this. I went to a graduation party in 1991 when I'd first moved to California, and it was my first time attending a party at a real legitimate mansion. Like, this was in the backyard of a Vanderbilt level rich guy and his colossal estate. He was having a graduation party for his daughter from college, and I went, and it had they had a help yourself margarita machine. Like, it was like a Slurpee machine, but it was margaritas. There was a trampoline. There was karaoke.
Okay.
So things got really out of hand and really sloppy really quickly. It was fantastic. And the dad who was throwing the party took his karaoke really seriously. And he made me do You've Lost That Love and Feeling with him, where I did the low part and he did the high part.
Oh,
man.
Immediately after that, First of all,
you're really lucky to get molested. Like, it's like just the next thing that was going to happen was that, for sure.
Dude, if I'd gotten blackout, I'd probably still be locked in a basement with like a ball gag in a trunk.
Okay.
But Tim's trying to keep it. I don't listen to this. I don't know what embarrassing things I'm saying.
I don't know where the line is.
Anyway, so we do that and people are politely applauding because is that, and then the daughter's boyfriend's like, I got next. He can barely stand and he chooses Never Gonna Give You Up. And he's so drunk he can't keep the mic in front of him. So it's doing that like Never Gonna Give. I gotta say, and then he can't, he's too drunk to read the lyrics. So he gets to the first verse, and instead of saying whatever Rick actually says, and it's the one time he gets the mic like right up close, he yells, "Oh, my bunghole's itching." Then he falls over and crawls away. And that was the greatest karaoke performance I've ever seen in my entire life.
Good. Hard to so talk.
That version of Never Gonna Give You Up, I have no cynicism for at all. It was the greatest.
So the thing that's funny for me is that I didn't even like, I didn't even really notice it. It wasn't a hated song. Do you know what I mean? Like, it was a song where I was just like, meh about. And then when it came back, I was like, oh, like that song is a big meme and a joke now. Like, I just don't understand why. It's not any more objectionable than a lot of songs that came out in 1987.
Yeah, I'm with you on that.
It's amazing, though, that our kids know this song.
Like, oh, yeah.
Kind of forgettable pop hit from 1987, and they know every word. It's bizarre. Yeah. All right. Let's do this. We're going to dive into Michael Jackson.
Yes.
In 1987, he releases Bad.
Yes. And
Ben made a passing comment back in 84 saying that he prefers Bad to Thriller.
That wasn't exactly what I said, and I'm ready to make a clarification. Are you ready? Yeah,
clarify, go.
Here's what I said. The best songs on Bad are better than the best songs on Thriller. And then I went and looked at it.
Okay, yeah.
Are you ready?
Yeah.
I think if you had a Michael Jackson snake draft for Beck's best songs.
Okay.
What do you think, in your opinion, what would be the first song selected?
Billie Jean.
From Thriller.
Billie Jean.
Oh, definitely not. And that's also false because you chose Thriller as your album and you chose a different song than Billie Jean to play.
Yeah, but that's okay.
The best song on Thriller is not Billie Jean. And you agree with me because you chose Wannabe Starting Something.
Oh, you're right. Yeah, I did. Yeah, I did choose that.
All right. So Wannabe Starting Something, in my opinion, is the best song on Thriller.
Okay.
I would take Don't Stop Till You Get Enough before that song.
Okay.
And I would take Bad and Smooth Criminal before I chose that song. Like, if you were doing a snake draft, and then it would be a long time before I got to,
I guess
it would be Thriller that would be my second favorite song. Oh, I guess it Beat It. I don't know, it's between Beat It.
What's the matter with you? Beat It is a great song. You're not picking Thriller over Beat It.
I don't know, I kind of like Thriller. But anyhow, I'm just saying, like, Bad and Smooth Criminal are fantastic songs.
Those are good.
And I would say better than anything on Thriller. That's how I feel about it.
Better. So I actually just listened to Thriller all the way through and then Bad all the way through on back-to-back mornings because there's a kid I drive to school in the van who only listens to Michael Jackson and brought the CDs. Like, when I get in the car in the morning, this, like, He doesn't even say anything. I just see this little silver flash as he tries to get me to put the Michael Jackson CD into the CD player. Wow. So I told him, like, you can have them back to back this week, and then don't bring a CD for a month because I'm done. So I actually did what nobody has done of our age and generation a long time. I listened to Thriller without interruption.
Okay.
And the next morning I listened to Bad without interruption. And I greatly preferred the experience of listening to Thriller, because maybe the highs are higher on Bad, and I think it's debatable, but the lows on Bad are
low.
Liberian Girl.
Oh boy.
I'm sorry. What? There's a song called Liberian Girl?
There's a song called Liberian Girl.
By the way, it was one of the singles. It's like the fifth single off of there. By the way, Smooth Criminal is like the sixth single. I think Liberian Girl might have come out before.
You know what's even crazier is Leave Me Alone, which was on Moonwalker, isn't on the original Bad. It's a bonus track on the CD. Like, how did they leave Me Alone off that record? The back to back of Speed Demon and Liberian Girl, I was like,
yeah.
Were we all like huffing paint? This record sucks. And then it recovers. Like Bad, The Way You Make Me Feel, I was toe tapping. And then Speed Demon's bad. Liberian Girl's not only bad, it's almost 5 minutes long. I mean, it's just.
Yeah. It's the night single. I had it wrong. It's the night single.
Which is a lot of singles.
Oh, yeah. Smooth Criminal, though, is the seventh single. Here are songs that were released before Smooth Criminal. I Just Can't Stop Loving You. That's the ballad. That's the first single. Bad, which is fair. That song's great. The Way You Make Me Feel, which is a bad song, but was a hit. Man in the Mirror, bad song. Dirty Diana and Another Part of Me.
Dang. What?
How does Another Part of Me go, Jeff?
Another Part of Me.
That was released before Smooth Criminal. Yeah. What were they thinking?
That's insane.
Yeah. It's actually funny to listen to those records away, like, I mean, because these kids are not experiencing as part of a phenomenon. Like,
right.
And I'm actually amazed they like it at all. Like, Thriller sounds like a record that was released along with a television cartoon for children.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, The Girl Is Mine is unforgivable.
Oh, yeah.
At the end when they're like, she's mine. No, she's mine.
You guys love like, hating that song.
She is neither one of y'all's, for sure.
All right. Like,
it's bad. All
right. Well, let's move on in the interest of time. And let's go to the, because I've got stuff that's going to take up time. And I think the number one selling album is going to invite Ben Barton to express.
Well, so now I previewed some of these, and I'm going to play what I think is the, I'm just going to play the beginning of one of the tracks.
Okay.
And for me, it's the beginning that reveals everything I dislike about this group.
Fun. Okay.
Ready? This is the beginning of track four.
It's the number one album.
Slippery When Wet by Bon Jovi.
Jeff, you get your browser open, man.
That's Social Disease by your friends Bon Jovi from the Slippery When Wet record. That's how that song starts.
Wait,
with
Social
the
Disease.
Wait,
that record came out in 86, but that's the best-selling record of 87?
Yep.
Yeah.
And that's hilarious. That makes me happy I did not choose that record, although I'm just still riding for it.
I
love it.
Holy crap. It's so bad. It's
I've
so
wanted
bad. It's
Dead
so
or
bad.
Alive. That's just how I do it.
Oh, God.
What is this, the one with Johnny works down on the docks?
Yeah,
she's gonna give love a bad name, living on a prayer, wanted dead or alive. But it has that song. It has a song called Wild in the Streets, which I just do not believe about these guys. And then the first song is called Let It Rock. Its intro's somehow worse than the intro of the song I just played for you.
Come on.
Listen how bad. This is the first 30 seconds of this album. I can't believe anybody like got, I mean, I imagine you would buy it for Living on a Prayer and then you put it in like, oh no, huge error, and immediately return it to the store. Listen to this.
Oh.
some ELP shit right there. That is not okay at all. Oh, no, it gets worse.
That's I mean, I could go on. It keeps going. It's an Emerson, Lake, and Palmer song. It's Deep Purple. It's also
how long is that song?
It song's 5 minutes and 38 seconds long.
That's amazing.
And hilariously, it's called Let It Rock, which it very much not doing over the course of those minutes.
Well, they were to turn really it around. They had to live on a prayer.
You know, the That's keyboard amazing. Player of Bon Jovi, I saw him interviewed when Slippery went wet. He went to Juilliard, the keyboard player of Bon Jovi, and they're like, wow, how did you, a classically trained musician, end up in Bon Jovi? And he looked at the camera and went, you don't get Poontang playing Beethoven. Oh, and I was like, you don't get Poontang, period. But I was just like, that was everything I hated about that band in like 8 seconds, was that guy sneering at you. Know?
That's all right. Amazing. Here's what we got left. We have, what are we? We're at 34 minutes. Oh my God. All right. Real quick. You're going to, I'm keeping you to 50.
I love that Tim has already decided it's a bad episode. It's the best episode we've ever had. I'm so happy.
I'm keeping you to 15 words or less for your answer. But in 1987, the pilot of a British aerospace Harrier jet, one of those Harrier jump jets, accidentally ejects from the plane.
I think we heard that at the beginning of track four. Hey,
the plane.
Anyway, that counts on your 15 words.
It's fine.
The plane flies by itself until it runs out of fuel and eventually crashes into the Irish Sea. And I'm just thinking, like, what a bad day for that pilot. Like, as he's hanging, parachuting down after having accidentally gotten out of this $1 million jet. And I was like, what's the worst day of work that you've ever had? Because now you can just compare it to this guy. Go ahead, 15 words or less. Worst thing you've ever done where you're like, oh my God, I am not an adult. I'm going to be fired. I'll go first so you guys can still think. I was once working at a car wash when I was 19 years old.
It's like 37 words already.
Not that part. 15 seconds or less. Left a car and drive, jumped out of the car. Car went through and rammed a BMW in the car wash because it idled very fast. That was pretty bad.
I don't think
I've gotten fired from a bunch of jobs, but I'm not going to tell a regular job. I'll tell an actual professional job story.
Okay.
I had gum surgery and they gave me heavy painkillers after the gum surgery. And I scheduled it during the interim between finals and the summer. But because I taught in the clinic, there were still some court dates. And so, but of course, and so I had a pair of students who had graduated, who came back to do a court date. They showed up in court to meet me and I was not there.
Oh dear.
They managed to fix it. They didn't have to appear in court. It worked out. Then they came back to my office and they were like, where were you, man? And I was so heavily medicated. I was like, now is when I should feel shame. Shame is the emotion that I'm looking for, and yet it's currently unavailable to me given how medicated I am.
That's pretty good. I don't think I can share my worst day at work because I'm sure I signed some kind of confidentiality agreement about.
Okay, good. Yeah, so, we don't want to, yeah. Okay. Yeah. Okay, good.
But I once shoveled an entire 2-ton truck worth of manure out of a truck into individual bags at a hardware store job that I had. And it took 6 hours, two of us just shoveling shit all day. And when we were done, the boss came out. This is in Maryland in 95 degree summer heat. He's like, well, you guys look really beat. He's like, why don't you guys both go get yourself a Coke?
Thanks, boss. All right.
Generous guy.
Yes, in 1987, let's go. Artist, pop, soup.
Andy Warhol.
Good. Piano, flamboyant.
Oh, Liberace.
Liberace.
I got that one. That was me. I'm going to claim that one.
I'm going to give it to you. This one's hard. Actor, emergency, bonanza. Battlestar Galactica.
Lauren Green.
Yeah. He needed Battlestar to get
it. I needed Alpo, and I would have gotten it immediately.
Oh, that's good.
Remember, he hawked Alpo for like 20 minutes.
Last death of 1987. This one makes me sad. poet, essayist, Beale Street. Go Tell It on the Mountain.
James Baldwin.
There you go, James Baldwin. Oh, that was 1987. In a nutshell, let's get to our three albums.
Our three albums.
I'm calling an audible at the last minute because the album I was going to pick is also not on Spotify. And if I pick two albums in a row that people can't listen to, I'm just a jackass.
I thought you were going to say it was Bon Jovi and we covered
No. So this is a band we have not talked about. This is not in my top five records of 87, but we've talked about all the artists that are. And I probably like the actual album that came out the year before a little bit better. But this is actually a really great way to try this band on if you haven't yet, or but you probably have. I'm going to pick the Smiths for 1987, and I'm going to pick the collection Louder Than Bombs. What's partially cheating here is I did not get the Smiths in high school. I saw them live. I'm one of the few Americans who can say I saw the Smiths live on the Queen Is Dead tour at the Smith Center in George Washington with three of my high school buddies. We were super hip. We were there before they blew up. And I do really like the record, The Queen Is Dead now. And I really like this collection, but the Smiths were a little jangly. They were super English. They never really rocked out the way that I was looking for. Like if you were listening to Husker Du all day, the Smiths came off as a band is lacking in a little bit of that energy, right?
Just, just for our English audience, because we do have a lot of listeners in England. What did you mean when you said they were super English?
Well, they were English in the sense that they were writing about places I'd never heard of. Like the reference points in the songs don't help you. Like, you know, when they write, you know, they write about the old, they're writing about places on the London Tube that if you're a Londoner, you recognize. But if you're me, you're like, I wonder what that is, right? Also, there's a British bands tended, especially in the 80s, to have a visual presentation that went along with the audio presentation. Like they paid attention to what they looked like and sounded like, and they looked like they belonged together, right? There were a lot of British acts in the 80s that, you know, they were put together in ways that American acts were still just kind of rolling onto the stage in t-shirts, right? And that was much more my thing. So I always felt a little intimidated by English acts that were obviously fashion statements as much as musical statements. So that's what I meant by English. I didn't mean it as an insult. I was a suburban, angry American kid. And then Morrissey's voice, it took me a long time, right? Morrissey's voice is very distinct. And I found it performative in nature, which of course it very obviously is, but I found that to be a deterrent to my connection to it, right? And it wasn't just the kind of, there was obviously a homoerotic quality to the Smiths, and there was like a gender bending quality. Like that wasn't it, if I'm really honest. And it's not like I was like the most open-minded 17-year-old Marylander, but that it was really that his voice sounded so stylistic as to be distracting to me. Like I liked voices that sounded like they kind of rose from anyone. Like and it was true of like other male voices. Like I'm not a huge Frank Sinatra guy because Sinatra sounds so much like Sinatra that I can't lose myself in the music. I'm like, I am listening to Frank Sinatra. And I felt that way for a long time about the Smiths. I've since gotten past it, not because of Morrissey, who's become more and more of an old crank and is not aging well, but because of the brilliant guitar work of Johnny Marr. I didn't appreciate what a profound technician this guy was and what a masterclass writer of parts he was until I got older. If you listen to the Smiths, what you're really listening to is just a masterclass in using an electric guitar sonically in four or five different ways in the same song. Like Marr's not a flashy soloist, but he's good, but he's a brilliant tactician when he's like, I'll take these chords and then I'll change the voicing and then I'll change the voicing and I'll put them on top of each other and I'll put one in the left channel and one in the light channel. And he's a great rhythm guitar player. He plays all these really intricate, fast strumming patterns without losing the specificity. And that's really what pulled me back to the Smiths. I rediscovered the Smiths maybe, I don't know, 12 or 13 years ago. And I fell really hard for them in a way that I never did in high school. And Louder Than Bombs is a their discography is a mess because all the American
albums are we talking?
Well, there's only the Smiths, Meat Is Murder, and The Queen Is Dead, and then they make a record called Strange Ways Here They Come right before they break up. But they were like the Beatles, and like they made a zillion singles, and none of them are on the records. So Loud and the Bombs is a collection of British A and B sides. So it's up and down, right? There's all these killer A sides. Some of the B sides are great. Some of them aren't so great. Some of these songs were album tracks in England, but not America. Some of them are specific to this collection and others. Like the Smiths catalog is hodgepodgey. But this is a great place to start because I think it's like 20, 25 songs, and it works as a mixtape, right? And it's 25 songs. It's only an hour and 5 minutes. Like these guys write 3 minute, 30 second, like pop songs. Like, you know, they don't spend a lot of time boring you with stuff you don't need to hear. Like each song is really tightly packed, and I'm going to play half of one of my favorite Smith songs, which is only 2 minutes and 5 seconds long. And the thing that I'll just say about it before I play it is the lyrics are imagistic and cool, but what I just love about it, right? You have a rock solid bass and drum rhythm section that are know not to do too much to stay out of Johnny Marr's way. And then you just get to hear Marr turn every moment of the song into something different. Like each moment of the song isn't just a different set of chords. It's a different flavor. It's like the sun parts, then the clouds come back in, and there's all this kind of, it's like, you know, eating ice cream and realizing that there are, you know, pop rocks in it. Like things just happen all over your headphones. And I just find it, charming is how I would describe Johnny Marr's playing. And this is a band whose first single is called This Charming Man. So I probably should have put that together 40 years ago, but this is called William. It Was Really Nothing. From my 1987 pick, the Smiths collection, Louder Than Bomb.
Strange Ways Here We Come by the Smiths.
The rain falls hard on a humdrum town. This town has dragged you down. Oh, the rain falls hard on a humdrum town. This town has dragged you down. Everybody's got to live their life, and God knows I've got to live mine. God knows I've got to live mine. William, William, it was
he's got one of the most distinct voice or it maybe not even voice, like styling of his presentation of words. Like it's bizarre. And it's so great.
I see. I don't think it's so great. Morrissey's no, still like the piece of this band I like definitely the least, but I've learned that it really works with this music. Like the marriage between, and the thing that's crazy about the Smiths is they recorded without him. Like, they recorded the whole track, the whole thing, nothing. And then Morrissey would hear it, write a melody, write lyrics, record over it, and the band would be like, oh, well, that's what the song is. Like,
that's so
amazing. Marr presented Morrissey with absolutely complete demos of instrumentals. And then Morrissey put those vocals and vocal melodies on top. So it's a really interesting,
that's fascinating,
marriage of two people not really working together, and it is that combination that makes them special. But I still, even listening to it now, like there are moments, I still have these moments where I'm like, Morrissey distracts me a little bit, but then now as a later listener, it's more than mitigated by how much cool stuff's happening around him. So
I'm trying to picture him like sitting there listening to the song and being like, girlfriend in a coma. Yeah, that's the lyric that I want out of this. It's hilarious.
Yeah, so this is a band that I hated at the time. And I've worked really hard to like since. You heard my thoughts on Depeche Mode, which I hated at the time and haven't worked hard to like. But this is a band that I've worked really hard to like. And Jeff's got it completely right. I mean, they're a little bit like U2 or REM in that the singer is really, really distinctive and the guitarist is really, really distinctive. Mm. Like Jeff could pull out a lot of Smith songs I haven't heard and I would recognize them because of those two different, that sound, that right. pair of voice and guitar together is just so super powerful. And he's completely right. Mar, the guitarist here is just fantastic.
Really good stuff.
All right. I'm going to go ahead and switch gears ever so slightly for 1987.
Okay.
So I said that one of my rules was going to be that if there was an album that was my favorite album in that year, I was just going to go ahead and select that album, except for Billy Joel, the Stranger, which Jeff wouldn't let me choose. This one, I think Jeff actually likes this record better than The Stranger, but he may still make fun of me.
Okay.
In 1985, there are two bands kicking around on the strip in LA.
Oh, no.
They are Hollywood Rose and the LA Guns.
Wow.
Oh, and no. They are not getting signed. Or they're in like they're in the turnaround cycle. They come together into a single band, cleverly named Guns and Roses, which is way better than their other option for a name, which was AIDS. That was one of the names that they kicked around as a band, which really would not have worked out for them at all. There's so many like versions of this where they just keep making the right decision despite how unbelievably stupid they are. So they get signed and they actually, so then they play together as this band and they're so awesome. There's an immediate bidding war for them. And it's Geffen Records versus Chrysalis Records. And they take half the signing bonus from Geffen because Geffen Records promises to just leave them alone and let them do their own sound, which by the way, is an amazing call by them. Like instead of choosing label meddling, they were like, no, we're just going to do our own thing. Take half the money and go with Geffen. They record the tracks for the album Appetite for Destruction. Their original cover art for Appetite for Destruction has a rapist robot on the cover. Again, convinced not to release that as the cover. Good choice by them. I think that was a good move by them. Hey, Jeff, what's the first single that Geffen releases from this album?
Wow. Well, I don't know because it's not Sweet Child of Mine.
Nope. That is the third single.
Oh my God, what did they think?
Just
was
pause
the
for
single?
A second.
Oh,
just
I know what
Americans
it is.
And anyone who's ever had ears, they listened to this record and they weren't like, let's release Sweet Child of Mine, which was a number one pop hit, like a gargantuan worldwide hit. And it's not the song I'm going to make Jeff play, but it's a fantastic song.
No
it's
question.
One of the rare rock songs that you can play for my daughters, and they're like, wow, that was great. Do the rest of the songs sound like that? And I'm like, I got some bad news for you.
No.
I got good news. That song's great. The bad news is you're not going to care for the rest. Jeff, keep going, man.
I'm
going
to guess it's Night Train. That's going to be my guess. If that's
Night Train is the fifth single.
Okay. I mean, I don't know.
Welcome to
the Jungle is the second single.
I knew that. I knew
and
that.
Actually released twice as a single. Right. It was released as a single in 87. Nothing happened. Crickets chirping.
I can't even imagine.
Then they wait another 6 months. They get David Geffen involved. And he's like, listen, don't play it in the regular rotation. Just play it in that weird metal show. They play Welcome to the Jungle and the Metal Show, which I can't remember. Jeff might remember what the name is of the metal, the midnight
Ricky
metal.
Ricky Rathman's show. What was that called?
Anyhow, like Harbin- I actually watched that show. And yeah. I can tell you that the first time you heard Welcome to the Jungle, you're like, ho! Wait a minute. Like,
oh, Headbangers Ball.
Yes. People were like, hold the phone. Then it broke. Then they had Sweet Child of Mine. Then they re-released Welcome to the Jungle. That's still not the first single, which is the B-side is the song I'm going to ask Jeff to play, which is Mr. Brownstone. They've had Mr. Brownstone as the B-side. The A-side, it's so easy.
You got to be kidding me.
I am not joking. That was the first single that Geffen Records was like, we've heard this entire album, which is packed with fantastic rock songs and got like a number one hit, and we're going to release It's So Easy.
That's just shocking. That is just
yeah.
Wow, I can't believe that single, didn't ruin them.
Sweet Child of Mine, fourth single, Paradise City, fifth single, Nitrate.
Wow.
It's really, really unbelievable. And again,
I was trying to pick the song that was most formulaic as the first single choice, but It's So Easy is weird and dark and has no melody.
Angry, and also, I mean, like, honestly, I like that song. And I basically like this record. Like, I listened to it again this week and I was like, wow, I pretty much like all of these songs. Yeah. Here's what I like about it. First, as everyone knows, I have a soft spot for hair metal. Like, I actually chose.
We know.
I chose a Motley Crue album. and I legitimately liked several songs off of Slippery When Wet. This is actually weirdly higher quality than that. Like, it's not a hair metal band. Like, it's an actual, like, Aerosmith remix. It's like a really weird story. Like, they wanted Mutt Lange, but they couldn't afford him. So they had this like mix and match of like these unknown producers. It sounds fantastic. The guitar sound is great. One thing I would ask you to do if you don't like this record is just listen to the first 25 seconds of every song. The beginning of every one of these songs is so outrageously good and thoughtful. Like, each one has got its own like little weird intro, and then it kicks you into the song. And the songs are short and kick ass. I'm going to ask Jeff to play Mr. Brownstone.
Oh, boy.
Very, very, very emblematic of this. It starts out with a weird guitar part, and then it comes in with a Bo Diddley beat for no reason at all. And you get 30 seconds of Bo Diddley beat, and then it kicks into the actual song. It's a great, and it's a 3-minute, 28-second just banger. It's got a slash guitar solo that blows your mind. I loved this band at the time. I was saying Pearl Jam was the first band of contemporaries that was really my band. This couldn't be my band because they're so lame. They're like so LA and lame. Like, there's a bunch of songs about like hot chicks and this song is about taking heroin. I was like, this is just not speaking to me at all. All of that being said, it's awesome. I still ride for Welcome to the Jungle. When I go to a basketball game and they play it, I'm like, that's right, that's where we are now. We have arrived in the jungle.
You're in the jungle, baby.
It just makes me so happy. The Axl Rose voice thing is a little bit much, but still, you know, what can you say? It's actually humorously, this is a band that reminds you of the Smiths. It's like a super unusual vocal part that you can recognize in 2 seconds.
Yep.
And a fantastic guitar sound that you can recognize just boom, right on top of it.
I mean, you can make the argument that Guns N' Roses is Smith's music for dumbass metal kids. Yeah, totally. Yeah, I mean, it really, that's not bad.
Yeah, totally. All right.
You have picked my favorite song by this band and from this record. I couldn't agree more. I cannot believe how great this song is. I understand why it's not a single, because you have to be a musician guy. Like, you have to be a muso to dig into how difficult this song is to groove to. It's offbeats and upbeats, and it's 3/2. This song packs a mighty wallop.
It's also got one of my favorite lyrics of all time, not just one of my favorite Guns N' Roses lyrics. I don't worry about nothing. Why, Jeff?
I don't remember.
Because worrying's a waste of my
time. That's right. Time. And to wait on the word time. To change
totally.
Time. I mean, did you hear that? It really makes you think, these guys.
Yeah. Let's hit it.
Appetite for Destruction by Guns N' Roses.
Dancing with Mr. Brownstone. He's
Mr. Robin, that takes me back to the University of Dayton.
Indeed, I'm sure it does, Timmy.
Fourth floor of Stuart Hall, which we named the Jungle.
Nice.
Thank you. Thank you to Guns N' Roses on that.
But it's super funny. I went back when I did the list. I was like, dude, I'm going to go ahead and choose Use Your Illusion 1 or 2, or maybe both. Like, I'm going to do that. That's a thing that I'm going to do just to watch Jeff's head explode. And it's super similar to The Bad Thing. And it's actually really similar to The Empire Strikes Back and Godfather 2 thing. I have a huge soft spot for albums that follow gigantic albums. Like, one of the reasons I was rooting for Bad was because Michael Jackson with his outside voice was like, I just need to do better than Thriller. And I was like, I'm with you, brother. I've got your back. And that was exactly what happened with Guns N' Roses. They put out this weird double album, like separately released. And they were like, actually, the liner note said like, bury Appetite. It's better than Appetite. And there are seven, Jeff might disagree, there's seven great songs between those two albums. Unfortunately, there's like 28 songs on those albums. There's some howlers.
Howlers.
Really bad.
Howling dogs.
And also, it's just like Jeff may not agree with this, but it's sad. Like, this was a band where this record is so great. So great. And then each of the next, like the GNR Lies, that's got a half dozen really good things on it. This is a band that could have hung together, and just the fame and all of the riches and all of the drugs and everything else just destroyed them. And in particular, Axl Rose, like, he just was never the same after this, like just a brutal downfall for that. And then, you know, he worked on Chinese Democracy for 10 years. Jeff, do you remember the bassist that he was working with during that time?
Mr. Thomas Stinson from The Replacements.
Yes, The Replacements bassist comes on to join Guns N' Roses.
You know what Tommy Stinson was doing before he became a full band member? He's the bass player in Puffy's band. Remember when P. Diddy tried to do a rock band?
And
He did All About the Benjamins as a rock song, like a stomping rock song. That's Tommy Stinson on bass and vocals. Amazing. He's the one going, it's all about the Benjamins! Like doing the Jane's Addiction parody.
That's awesome. Good for Tommy Stinson. That money's not going to make itself. You know what I mean? Yeah,
make that paper. I love Tommy Stinson. I mean, Guns N' Roses was like, I love that song, Mr. Brownstone. You couldn't deny Jungle or Sweet Child or Paradise City, but I could never go all the way in because the meathead factor hurt me.
Oh,
but
man, also, super misogynistic too.
What also hurt me, and I mean, I wish I could say like, oh, you know, I actually think that was a little bit of a piece of it for me. Like that GNR Lies record, they cover a Manson song and they do a whole bunch of dumb shit that they shouldn't do. But what really bugged me about this band is all the people who didn't like rock and roll who liked this record. Like it just bummed me out that like it crossed over and I was like, well, yeah, I love rock and roll because I listened to Guns N' Roses. And I was like, oh, there's so many other great bands that have a little more to say and reward a little bit more listening. And this, it was like, it was the record of that year, the way like Buena Vista Social Club was the record of its year.
Oh, or so
like,
dude, I think that that's super unfair. And Hootie was the record of its year. It's a great comparison Hootie. Piece of Slippery When Wet. Like these songs are so much better. They're so much better written. The parts are so much better.
Oh, it's everything way better than Slippery When Wet. Oh,
and like let alone Poison. Like, I mean, they were so vastly superior to their genre. And honestly, this is the best Aerosmith record that came out since Toys in the Attic, right?
Yeah, you're right about that, actually. It's the best Zeppelin record to come out since Presence, too. I mean, it's great. And it really did take that. I mean, hair metal was ridiculous to me. I do not have a soft spot for hair metal. I thought it was hilarious. I didn't get it at all. Like Rat, Cinderella, Crocus, all that stuff. I just was like, I really thought people had hurt themselves.
I like some Great White. This, and also I like a piece of cherry pie. That's not something I'm against.
This is different. This is all the worst song in this is better than the best song and all that other stuff, in my opinion. This is way, and it's Izzy Stradlin, I would argue. It's like there's a secret great musician hiding in this band.
Oh, but Slash too. You gotta give it up for Slash.
Slash is amazing. Slash is fantastic. No,
twin guitar attack. And actually, when you listen, like you listen to the start of Mr. Brownstone, you expect it to be a twin guitar attack where it's like a face, like the way it is in Aerosmith. There's like a faceless rhythm guitar and a fantastic lead guitar. That is not the situation in GNR at all. Those guys work together and they shred.
Yep. Yep. No. I mean, these songs, the big songs of Guns N' Roses deserve to survive. They're excellent, and they were the best thing in this moment in that genre, no question. But I don't ever listen to them, and I never listen to Use 1 and 2 ever. I mean, those are just, unless I'm watching Terminator 2 by accident, I do not hear the songs.
You're awesome.
Great reference. Hey, there was an urban myth I remember that the head of one record company bet Geffen that he could bring his band to more record sales. And he picked Warrant and Geffen picked Guns N' Roses. And then they just promoted the hell out of their individual bands to win their personal bet. Did you guys ever hear that story?
I haven't heard that, but I love that. And that sounds true, because there's no reason why this record was out for a year before it hit. It came out in 87, but everybody heard it in 88. I did not hear this song.
Keep pushing it, huh?
I love that. And they are significantly preferable to Warrant. I wonder what I'm going to look this up right now, what the Warrant record was.
It was Cherry Pie.
Was it? They got a lot of push for Cherry Pie also. Yeah. So
somebody tells a great story. I think it's Hall & Oates went into to meet with the president of the record company. And when they went in, there was a big poster of Warrant's Cherry Pie behind the desk. And they were like, uh-oh. I don't know if it's Hall & Oates, but it's some like.
No, it was Warrant going in and it was Nirvana.
It actually could be both.
It might be both. Yeah, you're right. Both. That's really funny. Right. That's really funny.
Uh-oh. All right. So it's my turn. And
we're
going over. So we're going to go ahead and stop this podcast. You know what we're going to do? We're going to draw a hard line right here. I'm introducing the hard line. According to Terrence Trent D'Arby.
Thank you, Timmy. Thank you.
That's a great choice. Which song you want?
There's only one. Please help me.
Let's go.
Introducing the Hard Line according to Terrence Trent D'Arby by Terrence Trent D'Arby.
Kissing like a bandit, stealing time. But by the all Saint Valentine's to my sweet lover and maid, slowly but surely your appetite is more than I knew. Sweetly, softly, I'm falling in love with you. Wish me love for wishing well. And tell her wishing well a butterfly tail. Wish me love a wishing well to kiss and tell her wishing well a crocodile she say.
Damn, I love that one. Damn, I love that one.
Come on. I mean,
it's fantastic.
I mean, one of the greatest introductory album titles ever.
Oh yeah.
Like, hello, I am emerging onto the scene. Introducing the hard line. I know we're running late, but give me 15 seconds of If You Let Me Stay.
Oh, I was gonna say I might like this one even a little bit more. Yeah. I love If You Let Me Stay. That was the one that sold me on him, was this one. I love this song.
Sweetheart, listen. I know the last few pages haven't been good for the both of us, and I've caused you a lot of grief. But put those bags down, okay? Before you make a decision like that, please just listen to me, because I don't want you to leave. I definitely don't want you to leave. Just hear me out.
So great. I mean, I'm sure our listeners have thought about the Smiths in the last 10 years and thought about Guns N' Roses in the last 10 years. But when was the last time you gave thought to Terrence Trent D'Arby?
Wishing Well is a top 10 of my songs that the girls like. They love that one. I play that song with great regularity. So it's on my mind all the time. It's super funny. I know that song. The thing I like about Wishing Well, so that's the Stevie Wonder song, the second one that you play.
Wishing
Well is a weird song. Like, I don't know who that is. That sounds like Terrence Trent D'Arby to me. I mean, like, I can't tell who that is an imitation of. Like, it's an actual legit new sound to me.
Yeah, that's true. But I also like the Torch Ballad, Sign Your Name, on this record. Like,
yeah, that's a good one.
It's a good record. It's a, if I could sing like that, I would do nothing else. I would sing like that all the everything I did. I'd be like, I'm getting some cereal. His voice, he could sing his ass off really on the record.
I had no idea he was American. I thought he was like French or British or something. He was, I was looking at his Wikipedia page. He got dishonorably discharged from the U.S. military in 1983. Do you know why?
Too much
singing all the orders.
He was in Germany. He kept going AWOL without permission to go sing in a band in Hamburg.
Good. You know who else was dishonorably discharged from the U.S. Army?
Johnny Cash
and Jimi Hendrix.
Oh, was he really?
Yeah.
We'll put a band together. Dishonorably discharged military guys. All right.
Timmy, that's a good one, man. I love
that. Good choice.
You're en fuego, by the way. You're doing
that. I gotta share that one with the kids. I think they would like Terrence Trent D'Arby.
Start with Wishing Well. I'm just telling you, my girls, like, that one's a magnet.
All right.
It's great. That little boop, 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 boop. It's just inexhaustibly great.
So, also just the way it starts with the kiss. Oh, so good. Your appetite is more than I can handle. You're like, cool down, Terrence. You're hurting my feelings.
All right, so it is Wednesday. Look at us. I've got a week to put this podcast together.
Hopefully you'll add more material so it'll be longer.
I was gonna say I won't know if you edit it, so feel free to do whatever.
Just keep adding. Here's another thought I have. All right, gentlemen, you've been great tonight.
Thank you. Well done, man. Jeffrey K. Good job.
Yeah, man. Bye-bye.
Hey, if you're having as much fun as we are, leave us a review on iTunes. Give us a rating on Spotify, iHeartRadio. Wherever you listen to podcasts, give us a shout. And then check us out on Twitter or at our Facebook page, 50 Years of Music with 50-Year-Old White Guys.
Ever thought about starting your own podcast? Do you have a business or a message you want to share with the world?
Well, now it's easier than ever with Electricast. Hi, I'm Mark Netter.
And I'm Peter Rafelson. We're the founders of Electricast Media.
Whether you want to start a new podcast or already have one, join Electricast to grow your audience, monetize your content, and build your community.
With our simple sign-up, you get free promotion, world-class analytics, premium ads, and personal support.
Go to Electricast.com and join our community today.
Electricast. Transform your influence.
Electricast.
Are you a fan of classic cinema or a young person who wants to discover the best films of all time? Do these legendary movies still hold up?
On the Generation Film Podcast, two guys who grew up when movies dominated the culture share a great film with a panel of young movie lovers and see how it plays for today's generation.
We discuss changes in storytelling, styles, representation,
the making of each film, its initial reception, and how its meaning has changed over the years.
Join us as we explore cinema classics across generations on Generation Film.
Electricast. Electricast.